This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
You know how you've been hearing about how prices are just going through the roof, and they are in many respects. And you've been probably hearing about the price of building a home, the price of lumber, that kind of thing. Well, guess what? The price of lumber is actually coming back down again. And what's amazing about this is that it wasn't that long ago, maybe just within the last week or two, when there were just insane prices on lumber, and it seemed to have no end. It was just going to keep going up and up. And it turns out that it's actually coming back down again. So this is something to be aware of, that, you know, these weird fluctuations in price, although sometimes it looks as though it's going to stay that way, in this case, it's coming down. So this is an article from the Wall Street Journal. I just want you to be aware of it. Lumber prices are falling back to earth. Futures for July delivery ended Tuesday at $1,009.90 per thousand board feet, which is down 41% from the record of $1,711.20 reached in early May. Futures have declined 14 of the past 16 trading days. Cash lumber prices are also crashing. Pricing service Random Length said Friday that its framing composite index, rather, which tracks on-the-spot sales, dropped $122 to $1,324. And maybe these figures don't mean anything to you, but they do reflect significant decreases in prices of lumber, which was just skyrocketing not that long ago. So part of the article includes this: the rapid decline suggests a bubble that has burst, and the question is how low lumber prices will fall. Even after tumbling, lumber futures remain nearly three times what is typical for this time of year. Lumber producers and traders expect that prices will remain relatively high due to the strong housing market, but that the supply bottlenecks and frenzied buying that have characterized the economy's reopening and sent prices to multiples of the all-time highs are winding down. So one of the things they're saying is that some people were hoarding wood for the builders and retailers and such. And that's when they were worried about running out of wood. And now it looks as though there may be a real glut of wood and prices may come down very low. So if you're getting ready to build your house, that's good news, right? 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Austin and welcome Darren to the program. Hi, Darren.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Welcome. Okay. Last week you had a call about SSPX, Society of St. Pius X. I really wasn't very familiar with that, but I'm traveling now to Idaho, and there's the one of the churches closest to me that has lots of daily masses is an SSPX church. I dropped by last night just to say a few prayers, and it seems like it's more traditional, and I understand the masses in Latin. But my question is, am I allowed to go to that and receive the Eucharist?
This is a controversial question, so I'm going to answer it by referring to an article that Father John Zuhlsdorf wrote. He goes by Father Z, and he wrote on this. He's written widely on this topic over the years. He's not a member of the Society of St. Pius X, but he is a kind of a student of what's going on. And so I'll share with you something that he wrote about this, because I found it very helpful, and it helped clarify some issues on this for me. So I'm going to locate that and share it with you. But the point I want to make here is that the controversy lies in the fact that the SSPX came out of a schismatic act as described by Pope John Paul II. And that meant that when the founder of the SSPX broke away from the church by insisting on ordaining the four men as bishops, he incurred excommunication, as did those bishops. So the formal, even though the SSPX was around before that, when this happened, it created a rift between the SSPX and the church. And I was recommending to that person I had talked about this with the other day to read Ecclesia Dei Adflicta, because there Pope John Paul II, through I think it was Cardinal Gantin, explained what the problems were surrounding this. And the reason I reference that is because ever since then, they have been in an irregular situation. And so it's hard to say, and not everybody agrees exactly, well, what is their status, and are their sacraments valid, and are they, you know, licit, and so forth. So let me share with you a few elements from this article from Father Z, and then I will post a link to this on Twitter so you can read the entirety of it, okay? So okay. Let me go down to this section here. So he says, here are a few facts. The SSPX, technically the Society of St. Pius X, is a priestly fraternity or society of priests. The SSPX does not have formal canonical status other than they are exercising a canonical right to associate with each other. Their association of the faithful does not now have canonical recognition. Hopefully one day they will be, they will be set up and recognized formally as, say, a personal prelature or some variant. However, Canon 299, subsection 1, says that by private agreement among themselves, the faithful have the right to constitute associations for the purposes mentioned in Canon 298, subsection 1, which are, for example, when clerics or lay people want to strive with common effort to foster a more perfect life, to promote public worship, etc. So he points out that under canon law, the SSPX is an association of the faithful. So then he says, could it have a higher status? And he says it doesn't have, no status. Now that sounds like bad diction, but what he means by that is there's something more than just simply saying they have no status. On December the 8th, 2015, Pope Francis told the Catholic faithful that for the Holy Year of Mercy, they could go to priests of the SSPX for the Sacrament of Penance, and that they could be validly absolved. That provision was extended beyond the Year of Mercy in the 2016 Apostolic Letter Misericordia et Misera. It stands today. This is a little odd because it was not really a formal grant of faculties in the usual and expected way to the priests of the SSPX, as when a bishop grants faculties to a priest to receive sacramental confessions. Those faculties are demonstrable with a document saying that Father so-and-so has the faculty. So this is important that you understand this, because it deals with the issue of the sacrament of confession. In this case, he says, there is no document that I'm aware of that explicitly grants faculties to the priests of the SSPX to hear confessions and to absolve. However, popes can do what they want in this regard. It's better when they do things in a way that makes it clear, with all the I's dotted. In this case, Francis said that people can be absolved by SSPX priests, and that, as they say, is that. Popes can do that sort of thing. Whereas other entities, such as dicasteries of the Holy See or pontifical commissions, have to use another procedure. So, he says, SSPX priests can validly absolve sins even when there is no danger of death. You can go to confession to them, not just because there are no other priests around. You can go to them because you want to, no question. So then he goes into the issue of celebrating Mass. So he says, this is really important. Another point that touches home with many lay people who love our Catholic tradition is, what about attending Masses? The Masses celebrated by SSPX priests are celebrated in a Catholic rite, no question. He says, I have written many times on this blog about fulfilling Sunday and holy days of obligation. In Canon 1248, subsection 1, we read that a person who assists at a Mass celebrated anywhere in a Catholic rite, either on the feast day itself or on the evening of the preceding day, satisfies the obligation of participating in Mass. Again, the SSPX priests use a Catholic rite, the Missale Romanum, and the other liturgical books of the Latin Church. So yes, you can go to Mass of the SSPX, not just because there is no other Mass, but because you want to. And then he says, is it sinful to go to an SSPX Mass? He says, it depends on why you're going there. He says, frankly, yes, it would be sinful to go to their Masses out of sheer desire to hurt local parishes or priests, or because you hate the local bishop or the pope or some aspect of the church, blah, blah, blah. Frankly, yes, it would be sinful to attend a parish where there are liturgical abuses that you happen to know are abuses, but you like those abuses and you don't care about authority. But then he says, frankly, no, it is not sinful to attend an SSPX Mass if you are seeking sound liturgy and preaching and other good people who desire the same question. So those are just a few highlights of a much longer article, but I think they get into the issue that you're wondering about. And I've known Father Z for many years, and I believe that his take on this is accurate and in it's consistent with the church's law and the general view of things. I'll add my own little caveat at the end of this, and that would be I personally would not do this only because I find that many of the situations I've been in where I've had long conversations with people in the SSPX, there seems to be a real, not hatred, and hatred is really not the right word, but a real disdain, a real a real condescending dislike for basically the rest of the church. And that is an attitudinal issue. We can set aside the doctrinal issues and the liturgical issues and the other things, many of which I have sympathy for the SSPX people. I do. But the attitudinal problem can be poisonous, and I have seen it poison some people. And I don't want to be poisoned myself, and I also don't want to see that happen to other people. So for me personally, I avoid them because the atmosphere there I find to be corrosive, and it's not conducive in terms of the spiritual life for me. So I add that to you as a caution only because that's been my experience. Doesn't mean that there aren't some really wonderful SSPX people. There certainly are. Doesn't mean that there aren't really holy and even perhaps very virtuous people there. I'm sure there are. But when you're in an environment where you're breathing you're breathing in the attitudes of anger and negativity and looking down on other people, that can be spiritually unhealthy. So I offer you that for your consideration. Does that help, Darren?
Yeah, it does. It seems like it'd be safer than just to go to, you know, I can go to the cathedral here and they have the noon mass and then going to that. A follow-up question.
Do read Father. Yeah, before you go to that, do read Father Aziz's excellent article, and I think he's very fair to the SSPX. He's very comprehensive in his analysis, and I think that'll help you as you sort this out. Mm-hmm. So, what was your follow-up?
Are there priests not ordained by the local bishop? Are they like outside of the diocese in their own organization?
Yes. Yeah, that's what makes that's one of the things that makes their situation irregular, and that is they don't recognize I shouldn't say that. They may recognize the authority of the local bishop, but they don't live under his authority. They have set themselves up separately. So their priests are ordained by their bishops. They are not ordained by the local Catholic bishop.
Mm-hmm. And if I wanted to go to a Latin Mass somewhere, are there other places that I could do that?
Oh, certainly. So what you can do there is jump online, and let me just double check it. I think it's latinmassdirectory.com. Let me just take a quick look here. Latin Mass Directory. There it is. So if you go there, it's latinmassdirectory.org. Take it back. Okay. latinmassdir.org. So in the search bar, you just simply put wherever you are geographically. What's the city, the town, the zip code, what have you. And then it will pull up all the traditional Latin masses anywhere around you. And you can look anywhere and find where it is near you. Okay. I hope that's helpful, Darren. Thank you. And at the next break, I will have a link to that article by Father Z. His website is WDTPRS.com. You may say, what does that mean? It stands for What Does the Prayer Really Say? So WDTPRS.com. And I'll get it up there on my Twitter feed as well. Thanks. Let's go to David now in Southern California. David, I'm told you're 13 years old. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, welcome aboard.
Okay. Patrick, I have a question about the Orthodox Church.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when you search up who created the Protestant Church on Google, it comes up as Martin Luther. When you search up who created the Catholic Church on Google, it comes up as Jesus Christ. When you search up who created the Orthodox Church on Google, it comes out as Jesus Christ. So my question is that true? And also, is receiving communion in the Orthodox Church the same as receiving communion in the Catholic Church?
Okay, let's start there. The answer is yes. So they have valid sacraments because they have valid holy orders. So their priests and bishops do, in fact, celebrate. They call it divine liturgy in the Orthodox churches. Remember, there's not just one Orthodox church. There are many of them. And they're called autocephalous, meaning that they have their own head of their church. So the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church or the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, etc. So when you talk about the Orthodox Church, just remember that they themselves are kind of separated into these regional churches. I'll leave it at that. So yes, they do have valid sacraments because they have valid holy orders. Now, the Orthodox churches were all part of the Catholic Church prior to the 11th century. So it was in the 11th century when this definitive break took place. But prior to that, they were all part of the Catholic Church. And so in those days, there was no Catholic Church and or Eastern Orthodox churches. It was all just the Catholic Church. And that's why when you look that up on Google, you see that their church was started by Jesus Christ and the Catholic Church was started by Jesus Christ. It doesn't mean that Jesus Christ started two churches. He only started one church, the Catholic Church, but they were part of the Catholic Church. So when they left, when they broke communion, then they, in essence, were living separately at that point. But they are traced back to Jesus himself through the Catholic Church. That's a simple way of explaining it. Does that help a little bit?
Yeah, I'm just also wondering if, I'm not going to do this, but if I were to say go to an Orthodox church on Sunday and receive communion, would that also be the same as going to my local Catholic church?
It would, insofar as let's say you were traveling, let's say your mom and dad took you to Greece on vacation, and there was no Catholic church on the island that you happened to be on, you could go to a Greek Orthodox church for divine liturgy. Now, keep in mind that more often than not, if they find out that you're Catholic, they will not give you Holy Communion. There's a very strong anti-Catholic current among many in the Eastern Orthodox churches. Not everybody, but many of them. And so my experience, although I've never gone to one and asked to receive Holy Communion, if they know that you're Catholic, they will prohibit you from receiving Holy Communion. So just be aware of that.
Okay.
If you want a good book to read on this topic, I would recommend, do you have a pen handy where you can write this down?
I can remember it.
Okay. Okay, it's a big title. So it's called Ending the Byzantine Greek Schism. It's by James Likudis, Likoudis. He himself used to be Greek Orthodox, and he became a Catholic. And he, in this book, he's explaining to his Greek Orthodox brothers and sisters, he's giving answers to a lot of their objections to the Catholic faith. So Ending the Byzantine Greek Schism by James Likudis. And if you have a good memory, I'll give you one other resource. If you go to the Catholic Answers website, it's catholic.com. Ask your parents, of course. Check in with them to make sure it's okay with them that you do these things. But if it's okay with them, if you go to the catholic.com website, look up Vladimir Soloviev. Or look it up this way. Look up Father Ray Ryland, R-Y-L-A-N-D. Reason is, he wrote a series of articles about a convert from Russian Orthodoxy named Vladimir Soloviev. This was in the 19th century. And Vladimir Soloviev, he wrote books and things for his friends and family about why he became Catholic. And he, too, responds to a lot of the objections or arguments that were raised by the Russian Orthodox people against the Catholic Church. And those are articles that are available for free at the Catholic.com website. So there you go. I hope that's helpful, David. Great talking to you. And tell your parents I said thank you for letting you call the show today. I'm going to take a quick time out and come right back right after this. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio. All right, we are back. Thanks for listening. 888-914. Dig that bass. 888-914-9149. To Minneapolis we shall go and talk to Ruth. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning. Yesterday you were discussing about how to choose a college, how choosing a college that would avoid the current indoctrination.
Yes.
So my question is, how does one go about choosing a college that would be true to, or even strong in Christian Catholic values?
Well, having done that for some of my children before, I can tell you that we look not only for the quality of the academic programs and also, you know, the school itself and what is the campus like, but also we look at the integrity of the program and what kind of fidelity does this school exhibit with regard to the teachings of the church. Do they make Mass readily available to the students? Do they have programs for the students to deepen their faith beyond just the academics? These are some of the things that we looked at. And we were very fortunate to have, as you do too, if you're interested, the Newman Guide. So the Newman Guide to Different Catholic Universities is very helpful. That's available. You can get a hard copy of that if you order it. And so it's Cardinal, let me look it up here. I'm going to have to look it up and get it, but they have a guide to colleges, and they rank them in academics and other areas as well, and that's very helpful. I can tell you, if you're looking, are you looking for a college for a son or daughter right now, or is this more of a theoretical question?
It's the grandchildren.
Grandchildren.
I want to be some help, the grandchildren, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, well, and, I can tell you that, for example, Christendom College, a wonderful little college, Catholic college. It was founded in the 1970s by the late, great Dr. Warren Carroll, is one of several wonderful Catholic colleges that I would recommend people take a close look at. Thomas Aquinas College in Ojai, California. They're also very good. Benedictine in Atchison, Kansas, very good. The University
Thomas
of Mary.
Thomas
Aquinas College is in Southern California. Ojai is a little town.
Okay.
Yeah. It's north of Los Angeles. So Christendom College is in Front Royal, Virginia. It's in the beautiful rolling mm-hmm. Shenandoah Valley countryside. I have very high regard for them. But also Franciscan University of Steubenville in Steubenville, Ohio. Benedictine College, I mentioned, in Atchison. The University of Mary. There's John Paul the Great University in Southern California in the San Diego area. There are many, and I'm not leaving any out on purpose. It's just that the list is long enough that it would take a while to go through all of them. But those are some of the really good ones. So I would actively pursue that. And, if you're involved in that process, take a close look at these schools.
Okay. Thank you. I have another question that unrelated to this.
Sure.
And sometimes I hear people say they had their marriage blessed. And then again, I hear some people say that they went in and had their marriage convalidated.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one and the same thing, or is there a difference among those terms?
Yeah, it's another way of saying this, that you had your marriage blessed, exactly. So the convalidation is the way in which the church can regularize a marriage that had some problems. And if you're in, I mean, do you know somebody who needs some help along these lines?
No, in our church lately, they had convalidation, and I thought, is that the same thing as, it was just a ceremony recently that it said that on the brochure of their getting married.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I thought, what's the difference between that and saying blessed?
It's saying the same thing in two different ways. Yeah, convalidation is more of a technical term. If you're interested, okay. There's a very good book written by a canon lawyer named Ed Peters. It's called Annulments in the Catholic Church, Straight Answers to Tough Questions. Mm-hmm. And it's not only about annulments. It also gets into convalidations and other issues that pertain to marriage. So that might be of interest. Okay. And by the way, I found that website for you with regard to the recommended colleges. It's called the website itself is newmansociety.org. So named after Cardinal Newman, N-E-W-M-A-N, newmansociety.org. And when you go to the section on the recommended colleges, you'll see the ones that I mentioned, including Benedictine and Ave Maria and Christendom College and Franciscan University of Steubenville and Thomas Aquinas College and Magdalene College and John Paul the Great University and several others. I mean, there are quite a few here to choose from. And there's just a wealth of information for parents and, in this case, grandparents who are looking for more details about these schools. I hope that's helpful to you, Ruth. I appreciate it. Let's now go to Teresa in Orange County. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Patrick. So I had a situation that occurred yesterday, and I'm just really disappointed in myself and how I responded to it. And I was wondering if you could give me some advice on maybe how to respond to this in the future. So I have a hairdresser, long-time hairdresser that I've seen for like 18 years. So, I mean, I wouldn't say she's a good friend. I've never hung out with her outside of seeing her to cut my hair. Right. But when I saw her yesterday, she was telling me how she has recently split with her husband after almost 20 years, and their divorce isn't final yet, but she is seeing another man, and it is the love of her life. And on top of that, she was talking to me about her teenage daughter who has recently come out as non-binary. And the whole time I'm listening to her, I'm sitting in the chair and I'm thinking, what can I say? What can I say? I need to articulate things properly. I don't want to, she's not a friend, so I don't feel like I have that, you know, relationship to speak in certain, you know, in a certain way. But I also feel like I need to tell her the truth and how she's going about what she's doing for leaving her husband and how her divorce isn't final. And I just could sit there listening and I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. And she's like looking at me like, respond to me. Like, she's like, this is the love of my life. And I'm like, uh-huh, okay. And I felt so weak when I came home. Like, I told my husband I just wanted to cry. I'm like, I didn't know what to say and I couldn't respond. And then her daughter had come in as well, and I saw like the love she had for her daughter, and she identifies herself as Christian, Protestant, okay. And I saw the relationship she had with her daughter. She didn't agree with her lifestyle, but she was so loving, and I just didn't know what to say to her.
Yeah.
And I just wondering if you can help me in the future.
I've been in the very same situation before where I have felt flat-footed and inadequate and unprepared. And then I look back later and I say, you know, what could I have said? So I can relate to what you're going through. And the fact that you feel so deeply about it says a lot of good about you, Teresa, because it shows that your heart is in the right place. So what could you say? Well, from time to time, you'll hear me talk about what's called the Socratic method. And it really is a way of talking with somebody and trying to get to some of these issues by asking questions. And so maybe you could have a conversation with her next time, like, well, tell me about your first marriage. You know, when you got married, what was it like, or what was your wedding ceremony like? And she'll tell you a little bit about it. And then you can say, well, in the Catholic Church, I don't know what it's like in your church, but in the Catholic Church, we take vows. We profess these vows to each other for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, until death do us part. So we're making a vow not only to the other spouse, but a vow to God that we are going to be, you know, with this person, come hell or high water, until death do us part. Did you make that kind of a vow? You could ask her. And she see what she says. And she may say, yeah, we did, but, you know, I fell out of love with them or something. Then you can say, well, that's interesting. I mean, how do you look at vows? I mean, are vows something that you break or that you can break whenever you want to, or do they mean something? And my idea here, Teresa, is that if you ask her these questions, it might get her to thinking about that, you know, and understanding that she is in fact breaking her vows. And I guess her husband is too, if he departed the marriage. Another thing you could ask her would be, you know, so the guy you're with now, the love of your life, was he married before? And let's just assume for the sake of discussion that he is also divorced from his wife. And then you could say, well, have you ever thought about the fact that if he was willing to leave her, that he might be willing to leave you at some point? You know, and to kind of bring up in her mind some of these considerations that she might be holding at bay. And that could get her to be thinking about all this. One difficulty is that in many Protestant churches, divorce and remarriage is fine. They don't see any problem with it. They say, yeah, well, Jesus said if a man divorces his wife and, you know, marries somebody else, then he commits adultery. But, you know, he also said in Matthew 19 that if, except in cases of sexual immorality, and so if there's an affair or there's some other, you know, pornography or something like that, well, all bets are off. We can leave the marriage. That's not, of course, what Jesus meant. He meant that if they were not validly married in the first place, you know, and they were living as husband and wife, but they really weren't husband and wife, well, in that case, if they got divorced, they're free to marry someone else. So the reason I offer you this is because you're up against that reality that in the Protestant world, it's very, not only is divorce and remarriage common, but it's also thought to be not really much of a problem.
Acceptable.
You know, yeah, it's acceptable for many of them. So
okay, well, I appreciate that. I'm gonna try that next time with more of the questions. I do know more details. She actually was willing to share a lot of that with me, so I'm just gonna think about it beforehand so that I can be prepared. I really was caught, like you said, flat-footed, and
yeah,
I just didn't know what to do.
I can
All
imagine.
Right.
Yeah. So now, Thanks. Hopefully, you have a little extra, you know, a little more to go on. If you're looking for a book that will help you deal with these kinds of unexpected situations, I recommend a book called Tactics by Greg Kokel. And it's all about how to handle yourself in a situation like that where you're not sure what to say. So that might be something to read before you go get your hair cut next time. And it might help you navigate through that, okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I will, because sometimes I feel like I'm so passionate with what I believe that I can come across as off-putting, you know? So I need to get myself a little bit more articulated and prepared. Thank
you. Well, this lady, you're welcome, Teresa. This lady is lucky to have you in her life because maybe you're the only person who will make an effort to help her with this. So Godspeed, and I hope that things work out well.
Thank you. God bless.
Thank you. Bye. We can take another call. Let's go to Minneapolis and talk to Joseph. Hi, Joseph. Welcome. Joseph, are you there? I think Joseph might be listening to his radio, so we'll come back to Joseph. Get him sorted out, please. Matt, thank you. Let's go to Leonard now in Central Florida. Good morning, Leonard.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, do you hear me? I'm sorry. I have a question. I wonder why Protestant theologians have so much difficulty in understanding the real presence. And I wonder if there is a problem with different translations of the word do. In other words, Jesus said, do this in memory of me. He didn't say, remember this in memory of me, or sing this, or pray this, or whatever. So what is the meaning of the word do? Why is that confusing to the Protestants?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure that the Protestants would tell you that they don't feel at all confused about this. We look at it and see that they're missing something, that they are, that when they look at John chapter 6 or when they consider the Last Supper discourses, they're not seeing what Jesus intended by saying, do this in memory of me. So the term do, in this case, has a sacrificial connotation to it. And you'll see, for example, in, I'd have to go back and double check, but let's say, I think it's in 2 Samuel, if I'm not mistaken, where King David refers to, I will do the bulls. He's referring there to the sacrificing of these animals in the temple. And so this would track with when Jesus said to them, do this in memory of me. What he was doing there at the Last Supper was redolent of the sacrifice that was offered by Melchizedek, you know, this mysterious figure who appeared to Abraham, and there was a sacrifice offered of bread and wine. This is a prefigurement or a theophany of Jesus as our high priest. And that was not lost upon the apostles. When they were there in the upper room, without doubt, they understood that this was part of what Jesus was saying. So the doing this had a sacrificial connotation to it, meaning this is more than merely just taking the bread and the wine and saying these prayers, but actually it is symbolic in pointing toward the sacrifice that he would actually carry out on the cross the following day. So there's so much to be said here. I mean, you can look at the Greek, you can look at the context, you can consider the patristic testimony. Why some people don't get it, I don't know. It seems really clear to me, but not everybody sees that. So I hope that's helpful. It looks like we might have lost him, but I hope that's helpful. So let's take this moment for a break and then return right back to the phone calls. Thank you for your patience and waiting. We still have some time left, so if you want to call and be on the program, call this number, please, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. The Day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
It's amazing how fast these shows go by. Thank you for listening. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. There's still time. Let's go to Joe in Albuquerque. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hey, you there? I'm currently, my brother has moved in with me, and he is addicted to Adderall. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to figure out how to kind of get him back on the right track. He's brilliant. He's got 5 degrees and he's an incredible human being. What advice do you have to help me out with this situation?
See, here you're dealing with a drug, and I don't have any knowledge or expertise in that area, so I can't give you any advice, because that would be like medical advice, and I don't have that information.
Okay.
You know, I'm not trying to turn you away. I'm just saying that you're asking a very specialized question that I'm not prepared with any knowledge for. So have you talked to a doctor? I mean, that seems like that'd be the logical place to go to see.
I spoke with his psychiatrist yesterday, and, you know, she told me, she's like, Joe, she's like, I've been trying to get him off the Adderall for months. She's like, but he has to agree to it. And so,
did he have a drug problem before, and the Adderall is sort of to help him step away from the drugs?
No. He none of us really smoked or drank did any drugs before. Yeah. And, you know, really since 2014, it was when he started taking it. There's been a major shift.
I can imagine. Yeah, this can destroy somebody, you know, physically and in other ways. Okay, I have a good friend who one of his sons has that very same situation. And, of course, I didn't have any advice to give him, but that's the kind of thing that a doctor can certainly help with. And is he willing to see a physician to see about this?
I'm not sure. We haven't really spoke about it. I brought it up a couple of times, but you know, it's usually very vague, and then he'll go on blaming everybody else for his issues. Mm-hmm. So we really haven't spoken in depth about it at all.
So, I see. Well, if he's taking it as a prescription, that's one thing, because sometimes it can be prescribed for things. But if he's just taking it because he wants to take it, that obviously is a real abuse, and it's going to really harm him. So that would be my best advice.
Absolutely.
Check in with the physician, see if you can get him in for, you know, maybe, hey, let's go in and just get a wellness check and, you can let the doctor know ahead of time that this is an issue that he can discuss with your brother. That's what I would do.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Patrick. I appreciate it. And I, dude, I love your show, by the way. All kinds of incredible intelligence on your show. So keep up the good work, man. God bless.
Thank you. Appreciate the vote of confidence, Joe. Let's go to Brenda now in the Bay Area of California. Hi, Brenda.
I was in at a different mass, not my parish. Mm-hmm. And when we went up to communion, I went to my pew and I did what I did and needed prayers and I got up. So, but then as the line was going, there was this gentleman who I saw give part of his host to a very young child. I was stunned. I was shocked. And obviously it's not my parish, so I honestly didn't say anything because I didn't know what to do.
It's a strange situation to be in. And oh, go ahead. To this day, what?
Sorry. To this day, it still bothers me. It really does.
Yeah. Okay, well, you witnessed something that was aberrant, that's for sure. Nobody should be doing that. That's why you were shocked, and I would have been shocked too. Nobody should be doing that. When you go up to receive communion, you receive communion then and there. You don't take the host back to your pew with you. You don't break off a piece and give it to somebody else. You consume the host then and there. Right. So that's what should have been done. Now, the question here is, should you have done something? And I don't really know what you could do. You could have, maybe, taken that person aside after Mass and said, you know, excuse me, I realize this is kind of none of my business, but then again, as a fellow Catholic, it kind of is a little bit my business. And I don't know if you realize this, but you're not allowed to do that. Now, any number of things could happen. He might say, mind your own business, lady. You know, it might turn into an argument, or he might say, you know, I didn't, you know, he may say, well, Father McGillicuddy told me I can do it, which is probably almost certainly not true. Or he may say, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that, you know, but the likelihood of that third scenario happening seems rather slim to me. Sounds like it'd be more likely to get into an uproar. So, you really have nothing to, your conscience should not be worried about you having done anything wrong because you didn't do anything wrong. And I wouldn't see this as a sin of omission either, because you're in a situation where it's basically hard to tell what to do, if anything. Okay. So maybe the one thing you could have done would be to tell the priest to say, this happened, I saw it. And if this man is somebody who comes to Mass on a regular basis, Father, could you maybe make an announcement generally that, hey, when you receive communion, don't break a piece off and give it to anybody.
Okay.
And the priest could make an announcement. How long ago did it happen?
Oh, it's been a long time.
Okay. So, you know, it's unlikely to happen again, but if it did, you could say to the priest, here's what I saw. And maybe the priest would be able to make a general announcement so as not to put anybody on the spot, but to still get the point across.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Brenda. You're welcome. Be at peace. Be at peace. And as with anything else, everybody, if ever your conscience is troubling you, listen to your conscience, just like Brenda. She's listening to her conscience. She's seeking to do the right thing. And if ever you find yourself troubled by something like this, the easiest way to deal with it is when you go to confession, bring it up in confession. Father, I don't think this is a sin, but I'm not sure, and I'm not really sure what I should have done. But my conscience has been bothering me, so I just want to leave it here in the confessional and be done with it. And then you can put it to rest, and you won't have to worry about it. Let's go to Maria now in Buffalo, Minnesota. Hi, Buffalo. Not hi, Buffalo. Hi, Maria. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you so much for your program. It brings a delightful insight into our faith and clarifying our questions. My question is in regards to which comes first, a civil divorce or a divorce or an annulment in the Catholic Church? We have a daughter who's presently going through the battlefield, if you will, in this matter, and has been painful. It continues to be for all of us, you know, her father and I and the rest of the family and herself and three little children. And so questioning, he was, they were married in the Lutheran church, and then the marriage was blessed in the Catholic church. I became his sponsor at that time, so the marriage was blessed in the Catholic church, therefore recognized in the Catholic church, and now we're going through this, if I will, battlefield. So, I know you're wonderful with insight and direction and prayers, and I request all of the above from you.
You're so kind. You're so kind. Well, let me put it this way. As I understand it, not being a canon lawyer, but as I understand it, the process of seeking a declaration of nullity, typically called an annulment, starts after the divorce has happened. And if I'm not mistaken, that may be a requirement before the church will initiate that process. Now, you'd have to check with a canon lawyer to be certain of that, but that's my understanding. In this case, you said that they had been married in the Catholic Church, I'm sorry, in the Lutheran Church, but then when they got squared away, that their marriage was blessed in the Catholic Church. Is that right?
That's correct, Patrick. Yes, okay. He did agree to go through the doctrine of the Catholic faith, in which at that time he asked me to be his sponsor, and I accepted. So we went through 8-9 months of doctrine, and the marriage was blessed in the Catholic Church. Okay.
So the possibility of this marriage being null in terms of its validity seems to be less likely given that. But the church will determine it. And so as I was saying, I believe that that first step is to initiate the process. You furnish the divorce papers. I think that's how it typically goes. So they haven't gotten a divorce yet, it sounds like, right?
That's in process, and it's taken so far like 20 months.
Oh, my. So is there any chance, any glimmer of hope for reconciliation? Because, you know, this is the worst case scenario, obviously.
Yeah, it really truly is. No, to be honest and truthful with you, it's just, I mean, it's a house full of issues on his part. And I think she tolerated and tried to understand, and because of her Catholic upbringing, you know, she believed marriage to be until death do us part, and it took a different route, and she had no choice but to have to leave with the three children.
I see. Okay. Well, I always try to search for the possibility of a reconciliation, and I realize it's sometimes
indeed,
not
believe
possible.
Me, we did too.
Yeah. I'll bet. How it must grieve your hearts to see your daughter go through this. I can understand what you're going through. So as far as your question is concerned, I think that's the answer. I think that you supply the divorce papers at the beginning when you start the process. And then, of course, it's guided, so they will give you whatever other information you might need. I recommended a book earlier in the program today, Marie. It's called Annulments in the Catholic Church by Ed Peters. He's a canon lawyer. That might be a good book to get because it does answer quite a few questions surrounding this issue of divorce and remarriage and annulments and things like that. So that could be a good guide for you. Okay.
Okay. Very well. Well, thank you so much. And please keep us in your prayers. Again, this is a sword on our side, and not just us, but of course the three little ones involved. You know, there are two of them are 8 years old and a little 4 year old, and they're kind of going back and forth. And God have mercy. It's been, and it continues to be, a very, very, the most difficult trying times in our 46 years of marriage.
Yeah, I can imagine. And my heart goes out to you. Well, hang in there, Maria. God bless you. And we'll hope for good things. Thank you. Let's go. I mean, how do you, I just think of those little kids. 888-914-9149. Actually, I shouldn't be giving you the number because it's so tight on time now. Let's go to Joseph in Minneapolis. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Patrick. I'm going to take you off speaker.
Okay, that'd be great.
I was wondering if you could tell me, when a person who we know is in a state of mortal sin tells you that they're praying for you or your family, can you still benefit from those prayers?
They don't really work because, as it says in John chapter 9, verse 31, we know that God does not listen to sinners. But if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Now, we have to understand that everyone is a sinner. And if God didn't listen to sinners in an absolute sense, then nobody could ever be saved, because we sinners have to repent of our sins, and that's a prayer to God for forgiveness. So he does hear those prayers. But if a person is, you know, living in habitual sin, does not care to get right with God, and yet says that he's praying for you, I think that passage seems pretty clear that God doesn't listen to those prayers. I mean, it says that verbatim. So anyway, that would be one of the passages that I would turn to answer that question. Does that help?
Well, it does. And if I could follow up, I was wondering, because I was reading, this is related, but not directly, that there were three priests on the Titanic that gave their lives so that others could be administered to. And I was just wondering, is that common these days for priests?
Joseph, my apologies. We're out of time. Look how fast it happened. At least we got that first question answered. So pray for that person, whoever he may be. Pray for him that he'll get back in the state of grace so those prayers start working again. That's it for me for now. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.